And unfortunately, we lost that in the switch over from one to the other. So, yeah. Okay, that's very good. Okay, so Alan, if you could go ahead and lead us through on Q&A.
All right, so we've got the Q&A slide there?
Yes, we do.
Okay, good. Right, first thing I want to mention is that the board's still thinking of the video conferences on various technical topics. So if you have any suggestions for us, or your friends and relatives who pester you with questions, desperately need to know something about how to use their computer, and this is the time, go to this website and look at our suggestions, give us your suggestions, because on Monday the board will meet and we're probably going to make some kind of decision on whether we'll go ahead and in what form we'll do. So I'm saying this is last call because it may be a moot point after next week. Right, the first thing I have is a follow-up basically on a slow hard drive. And I've got a few slides here produced from some comments by Tom Trottier. So Tom, do you want to just talk to these and I'll change the slides as we go? You have to unmute, or I can unmute you.
Everybody has the ability to unmute themselves.
I can't unmute
them. Unmute? Oh, there I am. Okay. Yeah. If I'm presuming it's a portable hard drive. If it is, then you can try changing the cable, and you know, preferably to a thicker one is would be a general purpose thing. And if it's a USB 2 portable, then you may want to upgrade to a USB 3 or a USB C disk enclosure. That would be that would increase the speed by a factor of probably 3 to 4, depending on the hard drive. A check disk would have fixed any problems in the directory structure, but it doesn't necessarily fix any other problems. Anything that reads the entire disk, including the free space, will invoke the, I'm just repeating myself here, disk's own Sector 6 fixing machines. But there are other programs like SpinWriter, Hard Disk Sentinel, that do things in a better way, and will actually, especially SpinWrite, will recover all the data that's there and make it not only faster but more secure. Often slowness is due to the hard drive finding problems or having difficulty reading. So if you fix the problems, it zooms along. Next slide. And this is probably the ordinary stuff that people think of when speeding up a hard drive. If it's heavily used, if it's very full, then that's going to slow it a lot. The emptier it is, the faster. I mean, especially when it's more, because when you create a file, it can't be put in one space. It gets put into a whole bunch of spaces. Here, there, and everywhere across the disk, so then accessing the new file takes forever. It's a good idea to empty it out, delete unneeded files and duplicates, or move files to another disk. There are even programs that will identify duplicate files on the disks and change them to be hard links to a single set of data, which then doesn't affect your programs. But I'll leave that for another topic. If it's FAT32 or XFAT, if you convert to NTFS, it may not be much faster, but it'll be a lot safer. My guess is that it's probably already NTFS, so that's probably a moot issue, but it does certainly apply to things like flash disks. Next. And the last is defragging. You can, Windows has a defragger in it that works, and you can set it to defrag automatically on a daily basis and so on. And It also, for SSDs, it enables trim, and that's a good idea to enable in general. There's also a program called MyDefrag. It's a few years old. It came from original JK Defrag from the person who wrote it, Ron Kessels. And it basically gives you a lot of control over it. And I've done this, you can create script files for it that will put files wherever you want on the hard drive, at the end, in the middle, wherever. And you can look into that. But using the default scripts, you can go back for a moment, previous slide. These are the scripts that are available. Analyze only, consolidate free space, data disk daily, monthly, weekly, defragment only, flash memory disks, system disk daily, monthly, weekly. And basically they will do more to it. The flash memory disks, that's for things like USB sticks and also for SSDs. So that basically what that does is it just defrags the files, and that doesn't change the access so much. It speeds it up a little bit, but it doesn't. It's really not a big benefit. The big benefit comes when you have a hard disk drive, and on a hard disk drive, the stuff at the edge of the hard disk. Goes a lot faster. My defrag can move all the directories and the system files, the MTFS and MTF and other stuff to the outer faster region of the disk, and sort and defrag all the files and directories using the default data disk profiles. It's quite safe. I have not encountered a problem with it or actually read of any problems with it, even though it's kind of an orphan right now because Jerome Kessels has apparently disappeared from the internet. But it uses Windows calls to manage all the moving, and it's safe to interrupt, pause, stop, or even go through a PAL or failure because it uses the Windows calls. And it's very customizable. You can move things. Next. Yeah, the programmer who's moved on. 4.31 is the last version. I would suggest if you have a hard drive that you want to run faster that you try running MyDefrag on it. And if it's a data disk, I have in my laptop, I have an SSD, which is basically used for programs and the operating system. And then I have a hard disk that I use for data and media and stuff like that. And it will, if you're using a hard drive, it will speed it up a lot. It also, there's options in it to use information from Windows as to what, for example, what files you boot up with to start with, and it will actually put them right out the front of the disk all together in the order that they get used in, and it makes your boot ups much faster if you're using a hard drive as a boot disk. But it will do a really good job, and if you look into it, you will see that if you really want to change things, and I did go into it and do a whole bunch of things, but now I'm just using the defaults because they're good enough. And it's but you can go in and for example put all your media files at the slowest part of the disk because you don't need to access them at more than 150 times like for a DVD or whatever. And that it would be my suggestion for speeding up certainly a hard drive. And it will do a very noticeable job. Are there any questions?
There was one question that went in from Joss asking, he knew about USB 1, USB 2, and USB 3, but what is USB-C? So USB-C is really, the Type-C is a connector, which is going to be either USB 3, 3.1, or whatever. So it's USB-C as opposed to USB Type-A connector is what we're talking about there.
Yeah, it's a symmetrical connector like the micro USB, but it's faster and it can deliver power to your PC and or phone. And it's the latest, fastest connection. It can go up to 10 gigabytes a second, 10 gigabits a second.
Mike mentioned that you can't defragment a solid-state drive. They don't fragment. And technically they do, but it doesn't matter where data is on a solid-state drive. Greg asked, is there any benefit to defragging an SSD? No, and you actually don't want to try to defrag an SSD. If your defrag program actually does anything, it will just wear out your SSD unnecessarily.
That's mostly true. And if you look at the flash, if you look at the script for the flash, you'll see that what it does is it chooses it. What it does is it moves, it defrags files by putting them together. And there's not a big advantage to that because. With a hard disk, if a file is fragged, you spend milliseconds going back and forth with the head, and it wears the disk. With an SSD, what it does or will do, it will put files together, and that it's a little bit faster when it doesn't have to go through a list from the directory of all the places where a long file is. So it can be very slightly faster, but it's not it's measured probably in a, you know, single digits of a percentage versus 400 or 500% for a hard disk.
Yeah, my understanding was that any defragger that says it's defragging an SSD is in actual fact just invoking the trim command, which is a way of consolidating space, so that it was discussed at a previous Q&A actually what the trim function actually does, but it can end up that if you don't have the trim function running, it can de-optimize the way that files can get stored, and you can end up with these orphaned places on your SSD that can't be used, and the trim function consolidates those so they can be used. And that's all the questions that we had on there.
Okay, thanks very much, Tom. That was really good information.
Well, if you have a hard disk drive, I think my defrag is valuable. And if you have problems, SpinWrite is very valuable. But it costs money. My defrag is free, and my SpinWrite is about $65 US, I believe.
Okay, so the next thing we have is a share, and this is Chris.
Yeah, I just came across this today, actually, or yesterday, and so it was an interesting history of Adobe and going from garage startup to an empire. And so Adobe was started in 1982, and it's grown into quite a powerhouse. Dominates graphics so much that Photoshop has actually become a verb. And so there's the YouTube video if you wanted to watch that. I have pasted that into the chat window if you want to pick it up from there. I've been pasting in other URLs that Tom had mentioned about where to get the My Defrag and some other things like that. So check out the chat window.
Okay, so now we're into the series of predetermined questions, and this is from Eldon. Has a new-to-me laptop that shuts down for no apparent reason. You're basically looking for a shop to troubleshoot and possibly repair it, and was asking if anybody has any experience with positive experiences with local repair shops. And I actually put this question onto the member forum, and we had one reply. Andrew Petrovich recommended Laurier computers. He's used them for 20 years, and they're on Slater Street downtown. I don't know if any, and I think Eldon was quite happy with this because it turns out they're a Lenovo specialist, and that's the brand of his Wayward laptop. I don't know if anybody else has any thoughts on repair shops.
I don't have any personal experience with them, but I have heard from others that have used Canada Computers, and they have some pretty sharp people who work there. So my understanding is that they are quite reliable in terms of repair.
Yeah, Bob Walker here.
I have.
Yeah, if it's a new Lenovo laptop and he's having trouble with it, get in touch with Lenovo. A few years ago, I bought a new Lenovo, and it was great for a couple of years, and then I had problems with it. And I had an on-site 48-hour guarantee for service. It actually took a bit longer than that because they had to wait for parts to come from China. But the service was pretty good, and they managed to solve the problem. And if it's a hardware problem at all, it's going to have to go back to Lenovo one way or another. So you might want to check the manufacturer to see what they'll do for you, because if it's a new laptop, it should still be under warranty.
It's a used laptop, Bob.
I've used. I think that there's every possibility that the manufacturer will do it at a reasonable price. I had an HP Spectre X360, and it was out of warranty, and they quoted me a flat rate, and I forget exactly what it was. It was determined that it was almost certainly the SSD, and when I got it back, they had actually replaced the motherboard as well as the SSD for that one flat rate, and it was actually a very good price that they quoted me, so I was quite happy with that. So the manufacturer is often a good route to go.
I have a Lenovo laptop. I've had it for a number of years, although I haven't used it recently. But I found, 6 or 8 years ago, at least their phone support was very good. And if it can be solved by phone, they may be able to do it. I also have a shop that's been around for donkey's years, probably 20 plus years. It's called PC Perfect. It's on Bank Street in the Glebe, in 779 Bank Street, pcperfect.ca. And they helped me with my Dell when it the video gave up the ghost, and then I bought a new computer. And they, at any rate, they seem fairly capable, and they do have some history. I don't have a lot of experience with them, though.
Okay, so our next question is about Flash. Our user here has some online educational material, but Flash is going to be discontinued in December 2020, just a few months from now. Does that mean I'll no longer be able to use the material? And what can I use instead of Flash? And I know Chris has some thoughts on this.
Yeah, hopefully the developer is still around and still supporting your material. And if so, they will have moved to some other technology, or they're about to move to some other technology to make sure that it's still available. If the developer of that educational material has gone away, you might be out of luck. But yes, Adobe is ending support at the end of 2020. This was announced in July of 2017. All major browsers have stated that they will remove support for Flash from the browsers. And so there are some other browsers that are sort of a little bit lesser known, but almost all of them are based on the Chromium engine. And because of that, the support for Flash is going to be removed from them as well. So the long and short is that, yes, it is going away. There's no replacement for Flash. And the website owners have been told for years that they should transition to other technologies. And the most common recommendation is HTML5, which includes all of the capabilities basically that was built into Flash. End users, really, you have no control over what a website owner uses. You go to their website, and if they use Flash, then you have to use Flash in your browser. And so if you have website owners or whoever this educational material is, if they continue to just say it requires Flash, you're just not going to be able to use it.
This is an issue for me because Bridgebase Online uses Flash, and their Flash, they have a new HTML version of their Bridgeplane platform. But the Flash version is far more capable. I have some suggestions regarding this. There are browsers that are being red circled, ended, the support is ended. Internet Explorer comes to mind. If you have an old version of Internet Explorer, keep the most current version around that doesn't go past the end of 2020, you will probably be able to access Flash stuff on the .swf files. Another browser that is Chromium-based is called Iron, and you may want to, if you keep an old version of that around, I think you can control whether they update so that they don't automatically update. And Internet Explorer, my understanding is that support for Internet Explorer is going to be canceled. So it won't be updated, and therefore it won't get rid of Flash. It won't block Flash.
Well, I'm not sure if that's true. If you look at this note from one of the Windows blogs, it also says that beginning in January, Adobe Flash Player will be disabled by default. And my understanding is that's going to be an operating system-based thing, because you download Flash Player and install it. If they disable it by default, it's not going to be available for your browser to use.
I think you would end up having to block all Windows updates in order to block that, because it's going to be in one of these all-encompassing monthly updates that happens, and you're not going to be able to go in at a micro level and tell it, well, update things, but don't update Internet Explorer. So I think, by and large, the people that are still using Flash, they're going to be losing their customers if they don't provide them with the material that they're providing currently using Flash through some other means. Now, as Tom alluded to, I mean, it may be less feature-rich than a Flash control, but it's the way going forward. And certainly if you use a browser that is supporting Flash beyond the end of this year, and you are doing so by making sure that it doesn't update itself, keep in mind that browsers are one of the most security insecure programs that are out there. And so I would certainly not use that browser for anything other than accessing that specific material. But even that probably is going to go away, because the person who owns that content is going to see that, you know, they're going to be losing customers, so they're going to move to other technologies.
Yes,
Bob Walker here. If you can download the actual material, it'll probably download as a .flv file, Flash file, and most video players will play those with no trouble. And if not, there's lots of video conversion programs that'll turn a .flv file into an MP4 or any one of a number of other formats. So that's possible. If you're using Firefox, they have an application called Video Download Helper, which is a helper app or whatever. That can download most video files to your computer, whereas in Google, they don't want you downloading a lot of video files because they own YouTube, and they want you to go to YouTube by default instead of having it on your own computer. But if you can download the actual material as a .flv file, you can save it and then use it in whatever format you decide to use it as.
That's assuming good for that the flash is only video playing. Flash can do an awful lot of other things. And so just having it play as a video file may not be an option for a lot of content that is out there.
Yeah, Flash is actually a programming environment that you can do a lot of things in. It's not just video.
Yeah. But if it is pure video, then, yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. Jocelyn happened to mention in the chat, funny, I'm having a Flash update waiting to install right now. So that is actually a good thing because people are going to have Flash for at least another couple of months. And so if there are security vulnerabilities in it, you definitely want those updates if you're going to keep Flash on your computer until such time as it is forcefully removed by your favorite browser's manufacturer. Greg mentions PC Perfect and gives a URL. I don't know about the context of that, Greg. What is that reference to PC Perfect?
It's one of the computer repair shops.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Gotcha. Okay. So.
Okay. We move on to the next question, which is for you people out there who have BlackBerry phones and notably BlackBerry Passports. What's available to keep it going other than just using it as a phone? And speaking as somebody who knows nothing about BlackBerrys other than people like the onboard keyboard, I have no answers to this one, so unmute yourself, put something in chat, tell us the answer, if anybody knows.
I don't see anything going into the
chat. While you're thinking about that.
Yeah, we can move on and come back.
We'll move on. And Chris has another share.
Oh, this was kind of cool. So there's tons of clip art that's available on the internet, but there's some issues as you go about if you're putting together a presentation or you want a clip art item for your documents or whatever, there are some issues that you're going to run into. One is licensing, another is quality, another one is backgrounds. So under licensing, if you're just randomly going to websites and you see a neat piece of clip art, sometimes it's really difficult to determine what your legal rights are to using particular images in place. Often you'll find websites that'll just say nothing, but that's not necessarily indicative of the idea that you have the legal right to use it. Getty Images has been really notorious for going after people where they have the rights or claim that they have the rights to various images that are out there. And if they find it on some material that you have, either a website or whatever, they'll just send you a bill for hundreds or even thousands of dollars for using their licensed images. And so they accuse you of it, and you know it's up to you to prove that you have the rights to use this particular image, and they might just sick lawyers on you anyways. I don't know.
Yes, Chris, they will. I was actually involved in an association that had that happen to them. I think we ignored them and made them go away eventually, but interestingly enough, the image that we used on our website was obtained from a provincial government website. You would think that they would be publicly available material. It was actually a picture of the legislature.
Oh,
we were trying to use it to highlight a conference in their city.
Yeah.
But it was copyrighted by Getty Images, and we got the menacing demand.
Yeah, really annoying. Another issue is quality. So a lot of clip art that you come across is going to have poor quality. You'll end up with lower resolution, or you know sometimes it might only be a couple hundred pixels square. And so if you want to use it full frame or whatever, it can end up looking really pixelated. And you can get simplistic images. So the one on the left being an example of the type of stuff that you might run across. You want one of these screen bean type images, and it's not really all that good. In really small, it might be okay. But if you look at the one on the right, you have nice shading on it, and you even have this sophisticated shading in between the feet. So quite a difference in the quality that you have there. And then the final one on here is backgrounds. So most clip art that I've found tends to be available in JPEG format. JPEG doesn't support transparent backgrounds. So the one on the left is the same as the one on the right, but saved as a JPEG. And so it has a white background, and you put that over top of something else, and you have this ugly big white square. The one on the right has a transparent background, so you put it over top of something else, and it looks an awful lot nicer. So wouldn't it be nice if you could use all your images that you find for any purpose, or at the least non-commercial purposes? I sort of separate out those because there are some quite a few instances where you'll find that you can use things for non-commercial purposes. I sort of figure if you're using it for a commercial purpose, then you should be buying your images as far as I'm concerned. I mean, it shouldn't be a showstopper for you to actually pay for clip art if you're using it for commercial purposes. Wouldn't it be nice if all images were of consistent high quality and a really good resolution so you could blow them up quite large and still have them really look good? Wouldn't it be nice if all images had transparent backgrounds? And wouldn't it be nice if all images were available to you free of charge? And I found it. So favepng.com. They have over 16 million free images available. You can search by categories. They have about 100 different categories, or you can put in keywords and just search by keywords. They say that all of their images can be used for personal use, and then in parentheses they say non-commercial use only. So I think that's a little bit of double talk on it. Personal use and non-commercial use is not necessarily the same thing. So, for example, the images that I put into this presentation right here, it goes beyond personal use, but it's certainly non-commercial. So I'm taking a little bit of liberty in saying that, okay, they say non-commercial use, so I'm going to go ahead and go with that. They do have consistently very good quality of all of their images that I've run across. They all have transparent backgrounds, and you can get them all available free of charge, or you can actually get a premium account. So you have to register. So you have to give them an email address, and they email you a link that activates your account. Now, an interesting thing is, if you go in and you create an account and you give them an email address and a password, you do not actually have to activate that account. You can immediately start downloading images. I'll come back to that in just a second. So a free account, you're limited to 2 downloads per day. But think about it. You don't actually have to activate that account. So you could go in and give them an email address of, jamie@example.net, and you can immediately start downloading your 2 images per day. And you never have to worry about that email that gets sent to a non-existing email address. So whether you want to do that or not, that's up to you. But I actually activated 2 real email addresses, and so I can actually do 4 downloads per day. A premium account, which only costs right now US $29 for lifetime, and that's their lifetime, not yours, or you could do it at US $5 per month, and that's listed as a 75% discount right now. You have no download limits at all. You also get access to premium content, over 1 million images, and you get no ads that appear on the website. The ads never appear on the images themselves, so you don't have to worry about that. So I found this to be an absolutely fantastic resource for anybody who needs clip art images or photographs. So it's mostly clip art type images. There are a few that are more photographic and things like that, but absolutely astounding amount of content there, and 2 downloads a day for free. Not a bad deal.
Tom in chat is saying that Earth and View can convert from JPEG to PNG with a transparent color.
Yes, you have to sort of pick a color and say that that's what you want as your transparent background. The problem that can happen with that is when you have, say, for example, you pick your white as, you know, typically around your clip art might be pure white. Well, there might be white in your clip art image as well, and that becomes transparent. And so you know, you can end up with some problems like that. I have done that where I've converted things, where I've made my own transparent backgrounds. They are never as good as the transparent backgrounds that are on faithpng.com. In particular, when you get things like the clip art that I showed of the construction worker holding the sign there, and there's that shading in between his feet, that is semi-transparent. So it's kind of neat because if you have a colored background or something, you will get that color showing through, but as a semi-transparent type of effect. And I find it absolutely, like the quality of these images, they are really, really quite astounding.
Okay, another question, this one about, this is from Bernie, I believe, using Outlook, the Outlook mail client in Office 2013, Office Professional 2013. He's got folders, so he's redirecting incoming messages to various folders, but he's unable to delete some old folders. He right-clicks on the folder, clicks delete. The folder disappears for a few seconds and then reappears back in the same location. How do I delete the folders permanently? Chris knows a little bit about this.
Well, there's an awful lot of ifs, ands, and buts about Outlook. Outlook is a weird program. First off, there are certain folders in Outlook that are required by the program itself. So Outbox, Sent Items, Inbox, Drafts. There's a number of folders that are actually required by it. I don't think that's the case here because I don't think it'll let you delete them in the first place, whereas this person was able to delete them, they just reappeared. So I don't think that that's the case in this particular instance. Now, Outlook is based on PST files if you have a POP mail account. So if you have a POP mail account, they are PST files, which are standalone single files that contain an inbox, a sent items folder, and you can create additional folders in there. So what you could do is set up a brand new PST file and configure Outlook to deliver mail to that new folder rather than the existing folder. Once you test it by receiving some mail and seeing that it's going into that new PST file, then what I would do is move all of the mail that you want to retain into that new PST file, and then you can detach that old PST file, restart Outlook, and then you'd be able to delete that old PST file. So that's one way if you're on a POP mail account. Now, if IMAP is being used, it's a little bit different. So IMAP doesn't use a PST file; it uses an OST file, so an offline store. And if IMAP is being used, you can actually have multiple clients, including the server, which are trying to maintain an up-to-date list of all of the folders that are in your mailbox or part of that profile. And so it could be that another client somewhere else is somehow creating this folder. When it sees it disappears, it thinks, oh, no, I want that there, and it's refusing to let you delete it, and it puts it back in place. So, as I say here, if you're using POP, this shouldn't cause this particular problem. But on IMAP, I think it's possible. And I think that the best option there is probably to try deleting the folder from the server. So almost certainly you have a web-based email access as well. So use the web-based email. See if you can delete the folder from the server and see if that then replicates down to your client software and deletes it from your OST file on the local computer. Those are my guesses. If anybody else knows Outlook, by all means chime in, because I don't really use Outlook anymore. I used it many years ago, but I'm not a current Outlook user. And I don't see anything in the chat. So we can come back to that if anybody throws something into the chat. But I think we can probably move along now.
Okay, we're at that time where any other questions or anybody have any issues they'd like to discuss? items they want to share.
Is there an easy way to move bookmarks from Firefox to Edge?
Firefox to Edge.
I think Edge has an import bookmarks function. Check the settings.
I think she's trying to do the reverse, though, going from bookmarks in Firefox to Edge. Is that correct?
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, check the settings in Edge. I don't know for sure, but I believe I've seen it. Certainly it is. It's there when you set up the Edge or when the new version of Edge.
That's true.
Okay, I'm really not familiar with it, but I've been using Firefox, and I think, I don't know, it may be one of my issues for getting the blue screen of death constantly, so I'm going to try using Edge and see what happens.
Yeah, I'm just looking here to see if I can see anything about it.
Edge.
See under favorites. Yeah, if you go into Edge and then you click on the dot, dot, dot in the top right-hand corner and you go down to Favorites and you'll get a flyout menu and there's an import option there. So I'm presuming that we can do that and it allows you to import from and it'll have Google Chrome, Mozilla Firefox, or Legacy Internet Explorer. So you should be able to import your Mozilla Firefox favorites.
Thanks. Do you know do they have a sync option as well?
You mean synchronizing between multiple PCs?
Yeah.
Yes, they do. You have to create a Firefox account and then log into Firefox using that Firefox account on each of the computers, and then it can sync between them.
I have that on Firefox. Does Edge do the same?
Yeah, Edge will do the same thing. It can sync between multiple computers.
Great, thank you.
Again,
my suggestion would be to keep using Firefox. it's just the Chromium browsers and Microsoft. They both harvest lots of information about you. Maybe you don't care, and almost you can't escape it.
She's trying to get around crashes, so I would agree that if you're having crashes in a program, it's sort of like when you're banging your head against the wall. Sometimes the best thing to do is stop banging your head against the wall. And so if Edge solves that problem, that is probably less painful to go to Edge than it is to continue to have crashes in Firefox.
I've never had a blue screen of death in Firefox. I do get it. I have gotten it lately by moving things around from an HDR screen to regular screens. And I hopefully that's been gone. So unless you have a memory problems, I think Firefox is better.
I agree. I've been using Firefox for years, mainly for the security issues. But I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it's something to do with Gmail itself or Firefox or I don't know what. But since it's been, I don't know, a month and a half since the Windows update, it's just driving me nuts. And it's happening both in my PC and my laptop. And so I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, the recent versions of Firefox have some new anti-tracking features to keep people from tracking you if you're using Firefox versus Google, which is specifically made to track whatever you do. You might want to try uninstalling Firefox and reinstalling it to see if that solves your problem.
Okay.
Or create a new profile and set things up that way. That'd be an alternative. One thing I've found, and I mentioned it in the chat, is that the Firefox extensions, uBlock Origin and uMatrix, are extremely good in blocking scripts and tracking and stuff like that, as well as some, I think there's a cookie auto delete I'm using as well. I've actually pared down my add-ons from the scores I had before.
Before we end up leaving, and I'm not trying to cut anybody off, but I just wanted to get this in time if I can. Joss happened to mention that, reminding that, is anybody here from Meetup? And so if you came from Meetup, if you could speak up verbally or throw it into the chat window, we would like to know if anybody is, if that's proving fruitful for us. And with that, I'll pass it back to continuing the questions.
One thing I would like to promote, and which people may like, is a website called radio.garden. And it has nothing to do with gardening, but you can choose by use of a map, a globe, a radio station from anywhere in the world. It doesn't have all of them. It doesn't have CBC Ottawa and I think probably other CBC stations. But if they have a website, you can play music. You can play that radio station just by choosing it from a map, and you can set up a bunch of favorites and choose from them. So there are a lot of really good stations out there, and this is a really nice way of being able to access them. You can also search by whatever words they use in their station. So.
I'm just putting in, just want to make sure, radio.garden?
Oh, it is there, Chris.
Oh, it is, okay.
Okay. Yeah, it's good. In the chat.
Yeah, okay, thanks very much. Yeah, that's neat.
Yeah, just want to put a note here about if you're having problems with Gmail with other browsers, I have an older, about 4 or 5 year old laptop, and I couldn't open, from time to time, I couldn't open Gmail in Google Chrome, but I could open it up in Firefox. and I recently, a couple weeks ago, got a new laptop that doesn't seem to have any problems. You may want to consider that it may be time to take your laptop or PC, either one, and back up everything. Back up the data separately, so you can wipe the computer clean, reinstall all your programs, and whatever. Because I've been into this business since the mainframe days. And especially back in the DOS and early Windows days, wiping the computer clean and reinstalling everything was basically an annual rite of passage. And things haven't necessarily changed all that much.
Yeah, thanks. It's kind of a last resort, but yeah, I know it's an option.
I would say it's a very last resort. I'm with Chris. I'd go the try a new browser route. If that works, that's the simplest solution. I was using Firefox for the longest time too, but they made an upgrade and they killed off a bunch of legacy legacy add-ins that I really, really liked and used a lot. So I basically had to find a new browser that would have the same features either built in or using different add-ins.
You found such a browser? What could it be?
Vivaldi.
Vivaldi, of course.
Well, I'll have to take a look at it. Because I haven't...
Alan has written about it a couple of times, I think.
Okay.
Basically a fork of Opera.
Which is fork of Chromium.
Okay, we are 5 minutes past the hour, so I think we should sort of cut things off here. But we have a slide announcing the next meeting.
I do have one question before everybody goes that has been bothering me on my new PC.
Sure.
When my new laptop, when I sleep it and then I wake it up, often my Wacom mouse pad is and needs to be unplugged and plugged back in again to work. Any solutions?
Have you checked with Wacom to see if there's updated drivers?
No, I have. I haven't checked with them by phone, but I have. I tried downloading the updated drivers, and at least I think they made things worse in other ways.
Yeah, I have had some success in dealing with Wacom directly. It took a long time to get the success, but eventually the problem I was having, they did resolve it. They are very friendly, and they're certainly eager to at least appear to be trying to help you. So contacting them directly might be a good idea. As I said,
yes, you suggested that before for something else. Also, is that you had somebody had a presentation about using Wacom tablets, for editing photos and stuff. Is that online?
I'm not sure. It was me, so touch base with me offline, and if nothing else, I can probably dig up the original material that I had from it. It was definitely my presentation on it. So, yeah, send me an email.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Okay, any last-minute things?
Yeah, well, just to wrap up, Chris, our next monthly meeting is November the 11th, which, of course, is Remembrance Day. And we have a special presentation by our very own Bob Walker, Computers at War. So if you look at the background here, I believe that's Colossus. So if you think about Enigma and code breaking and Alan Turing and the boys, that's, I think, what the presentation is going to be about.
Yeah, this goes right back to the very origins of electronic computing. And so much has grown out of that this is sort of the founding moments. And it's not just Alan Turing and Bletchley Park and the Enigma thing, but there's other things as well. So it'll be an interesting presentation. A number of years ago, back when we were back at the Science and Tech Museum, I gave a presentation on the history of computing. From basically prehistory and the days of the abacus and everything up to the start of the personal computer era. And there was like two or three slides on this. But in this case, I'm going to expand quite a bit on this because it's very interesting. And it really, really speaks to where we are now and the things people did. And it's not just the history of computing, but literally the history of the world and the history of freedom that that I'm going to speak to in this. So it should be quite interesting.
Looking forward to it, Bob. And the next Tech Cafe from the Public Library is going to be November the 23rd, and this is our very own again, Lawrence Patterson, with scam avoidance and trust. And finally, the next Q&A, of course, will be next week, next Wednesday, same time, same place. Any questions, send them to our suggestion box email address. And thanks very much for attending, everybody. Hope you enjoyed the show.
Thank you very much, folks. See you next week.
Oh, yeah. If you plan to go down to the ceremonies on the 11th, if you haven't heard, they're trying to discourage people from gathering this year.
Ah, good to know.
Because of COVID, so keep that in mind.
Yeah, good to know. Thanks, Timothy.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Chris. It's Bernie. Thanks for handling my question.
Well, let's hope it helps you out. If not, send me an email and we can discuss it further if you...
All right, will do.
Yeah, okay. Thanks.
Good night.
Good night, folks.
Ciao.
And good night, everybody.